Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Shift Extension podcast. Back with Sonny Whitfield. How are you, mate?
Good, mate. How are you?
Oh, fantastic. We've got a great guest on today. His name's Andrew Tagg. He's been very kind to offer us some of his time today. So, Andy, welcome to the podcast. How are you, mate?
Yeah, really well. Thanks, Nick and Sonny.
Some of our listeners might recognize your name from a very popular and very informative platform. Tell us a bit about it and tell us a bit about your career.
So I'm a paediatric emergency physician who work in the western suburbs of Melbourne. And during my training, I, with some friends, set up a website called Don't Forget the Bubbles, which is sort of dedicated to paediatrics and getting anyone that looks after kids a little bit better at looking after the kids in front of them. And we've gone on then to run conferences, teaching courses, you name it, really. And what started out as a really small passion project for the four of us has turned into this global phenomenon.
It's certainly been one of those resources that I've certainly used as a paramedic as well, Andrew. And I've watched it grow from strength to strength over the last couple of years. How many years has it been going now?
Was
it
2013? So we started in 2013, yeah, and it was just the four of us really trying to share notes. We're all in this. Tessa, Ben, Henry, and myself were really just studying for exams, and we wanted a place where we could share our resources, but also somewhere we could answer the questions that we were asked in the ED or in the hospital on a regular basis that we just couldn't find the answers for in textbooks. You know, one of the problems with textbooks is they're written for what we see today is written 5 years ago, so it's so out of date. And we thought, well, you know, we had all these weird questions that you just couldn't find answers to. I mean, the first few blog posts I wrote were weird stuff about, like, you know, what do you do when a kid comes in who's bleeding post-circumcision? Now, you're never going to find that in a textbook. Mm. You know, it's just not a thing.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be going through some sort of high index journal search trying to find out what to do.
Yeah.
But it's like that word of mouth training in a way for some of the stuff. And then we moved on from there, obviously diving a bit deeper into what we were learning about. And then, so the four of us started in 2013, and then now then it was like a couple of hundred page views a month, something like that. And now we've got over 250 authors. We published over 1,200 blog posts. We get 1.5-2 million page views a year.
Wow.
We've been cited by the WHO and, you know, pretty much everyone from the UK government use some of our COVID data for some of their stuff. Wow. And it's just this crowdsourced platform that we've created.
It all started with what to do post bleeding circumcisions.
Essentially.
Now I am curious. I'll tell you that there's going to be some paramedics out there literally asking what the answer is, because I mean, last year I was dispatched to a lacerated testicle from a 11-year-old who was surfing. I've got no idea how you lacerate your testicle when you're surfing unless you're surfing naked. I mean, there's a lot of questions that need to be followed up, and I still don't have the approach when people say, well, what did you do? Well, I mean, you know, applied a trauma dressing to it and had a lot of unanswered questions by the end of it. Just for those paramedics that go to that next, you know, post-circumcision bleed, the answer from Dr. Andrew Tagg is?
Put some pressure on it. Hey, you got to remember, you know, most of these circs are done in 4 or 5 day-old kids. So their circulating volume is incredibly small. And so, you know, the circulating volume of a newborn is a can of Coke. That's what it is, you know. So you don't need to lose a huge amount, but you know, we see kids that bleed down to a hemoglobin of 2, and it's just soaking up their nappies, and everyone's freaking out. Yeah, it's essentially a bit of gauze and pinch.
It's good to see that the fundamentals of trauma care still exist across all kinds of obscure presentations.
Yeah, exactly.
Nick, this sounds like our recent symposium where I talked with Dr. Johan about shark bite management. And there's a lot of similarities here between post-circumcision bleed, lacerated testicle from surfing, and shark bite. It all seems to be pinch, pressure, stop the bleed. With years of research, here we are.
Yeah.
You said you have up to 1 to 2 million website views a year, and you've been quoted by the WHO.
So when COVID started, we were basically collated all the data on pediatric presentations of COVID. Every journal article that came out, we got a group of us together, and we just basically would go through them all and summarize them. And we were the only people able to do that. You know, you have everyone, colleges and hospitals didn't have the resources, but because we've got people from all over the world collecting this sort of data for us, we had this massive database of like 900 odd papers. And so it ended up being that loads of people would go to it, would look for what our opinions were. And we'd get mentioned in places like The Economist and Nat Geo. But also, you know, WHO looked at our data as well, because we had done it and said, you know, use it in some of their recommendations, as well as some of the European pediatric societies. And it was an amazing feeling to just be able to actually make a bit of a difference.
Would it be fair to define it as a peer-reviewed platform these days?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it always is. So anyone can enter a paper for us, or, you know, a blog post for us to look at, and it'll go through at least two clinicians before it gets out onto the website. And the nice thing with, you know, putting stuff on the web as opposed to in print is that there's also that post-publication peer review that can happen. So, you know, let's say we make a mistake or something changes, then we can make sure, you know, that goes up there. You know, people can comment freely on what's going on, and as long as it's not abusive, we'll leave it on there. But it also means then that, you know, everyone's going to have a difference of opinion for some things, and we'll put it up there and we can have a conversation about, you know, not who's right or who's wrong, but, you know, the better ways to do things.
That's great.
Now, as a pediatric specialist, I've got some questions for you from a paramedic perspective. And look, I'm fortunate. I spent several years in the army before I actually joined an ambulance service. I spent a little bit over a decade in ambulance service, and it's been an amazing experience. But one thing that has amazed me, the differences in the recommended clinical guidelines that are given to paramedics in Australia. All of us in jurisdictional ambulance services are bound by scope of practice. They all have medical directors who will say, yeah, I know, and different things. But what amazes me is how something as simple as pediatric vital signs can vary so dramatically in one country. Why is there such a varying standard in something as simple as pediatric vital signs, do you think?
That's a really good question, Sonny. And I think a lot of it depends on the data sets that are being used to collate those. So certainly what's happening now is we're using electronic medical records in hospitals. Every child that gets admitted will have a collection of their data, but we only know what they're like when they're unwell. We don't have a set really that we can use for what well children are. And with a huge variety in population, and, you know, we've got that expanding physical size for one thing, you know, that makes a big difference. You know, everything we've got is based on stuff that was done in the 60s and 70s. Nutrition has changed a lot since then. So, you know, the kids are getting bigger, generally speaking. So blood pressure can be different.
I got to cut you off there. Milo is still 5 stars on the health scale. I think it's 4.5 stars out of 5. Milo is still up there with it's a healthy food. So don't.
Milo, as in the drink.
Yeah.
Or the meal, Milo.
It's still 4.5 stars regardless. So I'm not going to hear Andrew talk about, you know, we're doing things old fashioned. No, you know, it's interesting to even hear you say that a lot of the data sets come from, you know, the hospitals we're collecting data from, because that is where a lot of the sick kids are. How often do you see a healthy child there?
Oh, every day. I see healthy kids. And it's an interesting thing, you know, with challenges in access to healthcare, especially brought around by COVID and lack of access to GPs. We see a lot of kids that I would deem to be healthy. Every day I'll see a kid that's relatively healthy. But again, there's a difference between what you get called to in paramedicine as to what I see. So then I'll see those kids who've got, you know, cut fingers and, you know, and simple ankle sprains that may be brought in by their parents. Whereas, you know, the call taking system, it should be that any child that you get to see is an appropriate child. So, you know, they are unwell. They are always going to be unwell when you see them, as opposed to the ones that walk through my front door.
I think over time it will change as we get bigger, more sophisticated secondary triage systems within jurisdictional ambulance services. It certainly depends where you work. Like if you're a paramedic working for an event company, you're going to see a lot more well kids with those sprained ankles, with a concussion, with the some orthopedic injuries, compared to if you work for a jurisdictional ambulance service, say in a low socioeconomic area, you might see more kids with diseases relating to or conditions relating to the environment which they live in. So it just depends where you end up as a paramedic. You know, it might be an ambulance service, might be somewhere else.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I,
th-
I think there's a much higher presentation these days of kids with cut fingers, unfortunately, because it. I think just about every care facility in Australia has a policy that if a child's injured, they call an ambulance regardless. So,
And it also depends a little bit on, you know, your definition of unwell. So a parent's definitely, you know, parents have a very different sense of if their kid is sick or not compared to what I do. Because for me, I might see 20 kids with bronchiolitis in a day. And so I've got a scale. But for that mum or dad or carer, then the child in front of them is that one, their only one reference point. So they have no idea. And certainly, you know, when in Melbourne, we've had, you know, 6 lockdowns and no kids were going to school and kids weren't getting respiratory infections. There is a cohort of families had no idea what bronchiolitis was or any of these sort of viral upper respiratory tract infections because kids weren't getting them. And so when the final lockdowns ended and all these kids are going back to school and getting infected again, new parents who may not have had the opportunity to put their kids in childcare think, oh my God, what's going on with my kid? Snotty, runny nose, wheezy, making all these horrible noises. But that's just kind of normal for me.
And I guess, I mean, when we're talking about kids too, this is something that, and look, my paramedic colleagues might actually scold me on this, but I'm going to say that we can certainly improve in how we assess kids. When you're dispatched to a pediatric case, it is one of those momentary freeze moments where you look at your page, look at the information, you think, oh, damn, it's a five-year-old. What is a normal systolic on a five-year-old? What is a normal respirator on a five-year-old? What is a normal pulse rate on a five-year-old before I've even walked out the door? And certainly if I don't take that time to consider these things and even get that information written down somewhere, I'm going to be flapping when I'm there. So it's certainly something we can improve. I think as a paramedic, sometimes we're a bit slow to pull the trigger on an unwell child. They might be just on the cusp. And so one of the tools that we certainly encourage people to use, and there was actually a recent publication, the Shift Extension on it, was the Pediatric Assessment Triangle. It's quite basic. It's fast, and you can do it without even having to touch the patient, touch the child. Do you use tools like the Pediatric Assessment Triangle, or is there another tool that we should be looking at?
No, I love the Pediatric Assessment Triangle. And you're right. It is. I think what it does now is it kind of distills years of experience into that just snapshot gestalt look at looking at the kids. So thinking about, you know, their appearance, their breathing, their circulation. And when you just look at a kid, it's really hard for me to say or to teach people in some ways, you know, sick or not sick. But by breaking it down into individual components, it's so much easier. You know, when you think about that appearance, is that child responsive? Are they, you know, are they crying consolably? Are they interacting with the world around them? You know, those things that kind of make sense to us. And, you know, recognizing that not all clinicians have children of their own to be able to recognize what's going on. But by saying, you know, hey, this is kind of what normal is and this is what abnormal is, makes it a lot easier. And then, you know, moving on to that breathing assessment, which is really pretty much the most vital one that we're going to do looking after the kids. We know that majority of sick children have respiratory problems rather than circulatory problems. So getting a really good handle on how to do that breathing assessment, you know, just listening to them, you know, listening for a stride or a stertor, so that noise is coming in or out, watching what they're doing from a belly breathing, looking for intercostal recession, subcostal recession, before you even think about, you know, what your circulation is. And, you know, often you do get hung up on the idea of going, what's a normal pulse? What's normal blood pressure? And that's not really important. What it is does that kid look sick or not sick? And kids compensate so incredibly well in that the blood pressure is the last thing to go, you know? And I think if you're concerned that whether this blood pressure is too low, you should already have known that it's going to be low before you even think about putting the cuff on them because they are going to look like crap. And so it's those, you know, cap refill, you know, poor peripheral perfusion, that side of things. That's a much more important thing to get a sense of that. And you're right. I mean, it's really hard to learn, but rather than freaking out as soon as you get the page in and saying, I don't know what's going to be like, just go for that ABC approach. And it's so much, makes so much more sense.
You're what you're referring to there would be treat the patient, not the numbers.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's a mantra, you know, for the whole, for all of us.
Because even, you know, you say, by the time you've got a blood pressure, you should be well aware that child is reasonably low. I doubt that many of us out in the you know, on the street in someone's home can actually obtain an accurate blood pressure, you know, whether that be by manual means or the non-invasive automatic.
Yeah, I'd much rather do a cap refill. And, you know, cap refill has its own issues, but I don't want a one-off. I want to, this is what it was when I turned up at the scene, and this is what's happened after my intervention or when I arrive at the hospital. No, things are different. It doesn't bother me if it's, you know, if you've got a cap refill of 3 seconds, great. That actually gives me nothing, because the cap refill you do, Sonny, and the cap refill I do may be different, but that doesn't mean that they're different, if that makes sense.
And it's interesting too, because I mean, look, paramedicine draws a lot of its resources from medicine, you know, and I mean, that's the definition of paramedic, right? Next to doctor or side by doctor. We draw a lot of it from medicine, but medicine is an incredibly opinionated field to have to navigate. Nick and I have both been scolded in the past for even giving cap refill any, you know, semblance of, you know, weight behind something. But it, I mean, for me, it's such a valuable tool as part of a gross perfusion assessment, but it's such an opinionated minefield to navigate medicine. And I think it gets a little bit worse in paramedicine too, because you're getting people taking things from other areas and then bringing them into ours. And it's like this collision of,
yeah.
I'll call it ideas. I could call it opinions and I could call it something worse, but we'll call it ideas for now to keep it positive. But over the 10 years I've been, you know, running around the street, I've decided that medicine is basically trial and error with notes.
Yep. I love that idea. Yeah, that makes so much sense. And the thing is, if you look at a lot of the literature for what we do, so much of the stuff is based on flawed stuff from the 1940s and 50s. And, you know, if you think about it, just in adult practice, we're talking about, you know, cricoid, you know, the massive debate about cricoid pressure when we're intubating people. And you look at the original paper and it's like based on 14 goats or dogs that have been intubated, not even humans. But, you know, we quote this stuff all the time. Or, you know, and then you look a bit deeper and, you know, cap refill is based on like 60 kids. And they can't even tell you what cap refill is. Or when you think about what your temperatures, you know, what a fever is in adults and kids. You know, we use this centigrade scale over here in Australia. And the core body temperature is based on something that has a 1 degree, you know, range of error. And so, you know, a mild fever of 37.8. What does that mean? That doesn't mean they've got a temperature 37.8. That means their temperature could be 36.8 or, you know, 38.8. It's not really a useful test, a lot of what we do. So it's so much more about, you know, looking, listening and feeling rather than the numbers.
Are you advocating for us to go back to something as archaic as Fahrenheit?
God, no.
Okay.
No, absolutely not. I couldn't even understand those numbers. But, you know.
Are we going to have to get a little, like, glass thermometer that goes?
Oh, jeez, yeah. Well, it won't get in the mouth anyway, Nick. You'd have to go in up the arse, because that's much more sensitive than in the mouth.
Now, while we're on the topic of fevers in kids.
I didn't know where that was going.
No, this is a family-friendly podcast. Steve?
Right, sorry.
While on the topic of kids, we always like to try and dispel some myths or get some different opinions about certain things that happen within the profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to hear your opinion about treating fevers with Panadol in kids.
Okay, that's a really...
Do I, don't
really...
I? When to, yeah,
that's
when
a really good
to.
Question. So I guess... things have changed since I qualified, you know, 1,000 years ago. But realistically, a fever probably has an evolutionary purpose, so that as your body temperature rises, any invading organisms, so the, you know, bacteria, viruses, are less likely to propagate and survive. And so our body increases the set point potentially to help get rid of some stuff. So therefore, bringing a temperature down may increase the length of time that a disease goes on for. That being said, that sometimes the fever is a response, you know, it's basically, you know, your SIRS response. If a child has a temperature, let's say 38 degrees, but they are happy and playing and otherwise well and watching Paw Patrol and eating, there is no value whatsoever in giving them paracetamol or ibuprofen or whatever you're going to use. All you're doing is treating, again, it's about treating a number. If the child in front of you is miserable and cranky as and won't settle and they've got a temperature of 38.5, yeah, go ahead and treat it. But they could also be cranky and won't settle, and they've got a temperature of 36.5, you know, a normal temperature. And you know, what are you treating then? You're treating the underlying cause rather than anything else. So it may be that they're cranky because their teeth hurt, or they've got aphthous ulcers, or they've got a, you know, it hurts when they pee. And so you're treating that thing rather than the temperature that was causing the crankiness. And I guess one of the concerns that a lot of parents and paramedics have is that, oh my goodness, this temperature is so high, this kid is going to have a seizure, you know, have febrile convulsion. We all worry about that. And I'll see it on a regular basis that parents will bring their kid in, you know, oh my goodness, the temperature is 39 degrees, this kid's going to have a fit. And they might have seen those videos back in the 70s when, you know, people were boiling, you know, for eggs in frying pans on car bonnets and all this sort of thing, saying, oh no, this is what happens to your brain if it gets super hot. But it doesn't make a difference. So if I control a temperature, it doesn't change your risk of having a febrile convulsion. So it's much more likely to be the underlying disease process that causes the febrile convulsion rather than anything else. So if you've had, you know, if you've had a febrile illness, bringing the temperature down does not decrease the risk of having a febrile convulsion. Does that make sense?
Oh, 100%. It's very well explained. You should start an education platform.
I'm gonna have to show my wife that part of the podcast, because we've had these debates in the past with our own children, when we shouldn't be giving paracetamol at home, because it, as Nick said, you know, these things are in flux and there's a lot of different information out there.
Oh, but I've had exactly the same challenge at home as well, Sonny. You know, and I can go on about this as long as I like. And so sometimes you treat your wife, not your kids.
And sometimes she treats me too, but you know, it's similar to when I was in the army. Hey, yeah, something interesting, Andrew. You mentioned before, you know, these discussions that you have in the ED is a lot of the inspiration for some of the articles, and it was part of the inspiration for the platform launching. And you said that, you know, some of these clinicians, some of these physicians, some of these nurses, they don't have kids of their own to relate this stuff to. Now, when I look back on my own experience, before I had kids, I could separate emotionally from the pediatric cases. I could basically run them like numbers, and then I could bounce to the next job. Since I've had kids myself as a paramedic, I'm far more attuned to pediatric care, what children need. But I don't want to say I'm less able, but let's say I'm less able to separate emotionally from them. I find that I've become almost a bit of a marshmallow. Now, this is from, you know, I mean, this part of emergency medicine that we work in, paramedicine, we're kind of a jack of all trades and master of none. And so we coined our own area that we can call our own, and then we can claim that we're masters of it. That's a separate story. But you have gone into pediatrics as a specialty, and you're also a father with children at home. How do you, or do you manage to separate emotionally from the patients that you see? I mean, you're talking about the bronchiolitis cases that you see, and, you know, I mean, you see a lot of pediatric cases. Does it desensitize you, or do you have your own strategy to move forwards?
It's a really, really interesting question. So I think there's two elements to this. There's the, as a clinician, does my knowledge of pediatrics change how I interact when my children are unwell? That's one element. And then the other one is, does being a father impact on my ability to decompress or, you know, manage it at work? And so dealing with my own kids, what's really interesting is that I think I'm more likely to minimize what potentially is wrong with them. And I'd love to, there must be a paper to be done somewhere that's saying that, you know, children of doctors are much more likely to present late with fractures and appendicitis and all these things because, no, there's nothing wrong with you. Just suck it up, princess. It's going to be fine. And, you know, I'm sure that I know of a number of friends whose kids have ended up coming into hospital 2 or 3 days after they've broken their arm and they've got the buccal fracture. Oh, no, just take some paracetamol. It'll get better. And clearly it hasn't. So there's that element to things. Or, for instance, you know, I remember when my eldest was 2 years old and had nasty hand, foot, mouth and had horrible mouth ulcers. And if I'd seen her as a child in hospital, nothing related to me, then I may have thought about putting a nasogastric in for rapid rehydration or something. But no, not at home. No, have some have some paracetamol and some lignocaine, have some icy pills, it'll get better. And so, you know, there's that element. But the other side, I think you do become so much more empathic towards the parents in front of you. And that is a good thing in some ways, and it is a bad thing in some ways. So I find it much easier to relate to parents in hospital. So often you might get a parent that comes in, you know, the child's, let's say, and we use bronchiolitis because it's pretty much one of the commonest presentations we're seeing, or gastroenteritis, for instance. And, oh, this kid's not had anything to eat or drink for 24, 48 hours. And for me, it may be that I look at this child and think, okay, this kid's not that sick. They're not overly dehydrated. They're okay. But as a parent, I can step back and say, but I recognize that mom or dad or auntie or uncle or whatever have had 48 hours of this nonstop, but they've barely had any sleep because this kid's been crying half the night and been giving them paracetamol. And I know then that they need extra support. And so I understand it's easier. I find it a little bit easier to relate to why the parents are bringing the children in to me, because they are at their wits end. Parents are exhausted. You know, you get these parents who come in with kids with inconsolable crying. And as soon as you take the child from them to examine them, the kid stops crying and that's it. And it's weird because you can recognize, you know, that sort of, you know, and the emotions that the parents are feeling are contagious to their newborn in a way. And just being able to take that kid away from them gives the parents a bit of relief. But you can also recognize these parents are just shattered because they've had no sleep at all. What has been really hard for me is that when I've seen very sick children at work or kids that have unfortunately passed away that have been the same age as my children. And I find that really, really hard. In the moment, I am very good at putting stuff in a box and being the doctor and just dealing with it. And so I remember one really unfortunate case when we'd had a three-year-old who'd passed away from nasty myocarditis. And it was so unexpected. And, you know, the dad had just gone home to get some stuff, you know, for the kids to stay in hospital. And then just even in that journey, she'd passed away. And then at the moment, while doing the resuscitation and everything else, I was just so focused on doing the best job I could for her. And then what I had to, you know, then, you know, go home at the end of my shift and make sure I was totally present with my daughter at the time. And that's what I needed for me. Give her a big hug. And you may recognize it yourself that sometimes your kids can be really annoying. And they want your attention all the time. And all you really want to do is just do something on your phone or watch some TV. But in those moments when you've had awful days at work, it's a case of, actually, this is a time when I recognize I've got to be really present with my children, put the mobile away, put the laptop away, do all that sort of stuff, and just be there and recognize that this moment that I have is never going to happen again. And it's really humbling to think that sometimes, you know, I remember reading a quote once saying, you know, there's going to come a day when you pick up your child and it's the very last time you pick them up because it's going to stop because they're going to get too heavy or whatever. And it's hard, isn't it?
It's quite profound. It is a challenge. It's interesting. Like I said, I became a marshmallow when I became a dad with pediatric cases. So, you know, often if I've had the joys of a partner and we're going to a pediatric case, often on the way there, I've said, hey, you're up. I'll be behind you. I'll support you with everything you need. I'll be behind you. Recently, I went to a pediatric case and the little girl was suffering a very similar genetic disorder to the one that my daughter suffers. And I actually found that it actually enabled me to provide much better care, not just for the little girl, but also for the mother that was riding along with us, because suddenly she had someone that she could relate to. And I found that quite an uplifting experience, even for myself as a paramedic and a father. So it goes in ebbs and flows, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's really important to have someone to be able to talk to about this outside of, you know, your immediate action. Because, you know, whether it's a good friend or your partner or, you know, your wife or husband or boyfriend or whatever, it can get really, really oppressive if you just hold all that tension in. afterwards. And so you just got to be able to let it go, because otherwise you just start ruminating on these cases, you know, these challenging cases that think, oh my God, you know, what if cases, your brain starts to wear away, and it really does. It can cause problems. So it's really important to make sure you have someone you can talk to. And sometimes what I found was the easiest thing then to do was just to sit and write. If I didn't have anyone to talk to at the time, not just, you know, notes or, you know, doing the vacus or whatever else, but actually just sitting down and writing down how I was feeling and what I was feeling and just chucking on a bit of paper, doesn't have to be for anyone to read, actually made it easier for me to just to switch off and transition into being a normal human being again.
I think that's a really, really valuable note for people to take away as well. Certainly for myself, I've been writing for a long time, just as a way of processing things, as a way of helping me understand things. And that was also part of the reason that, you know, the shift extension was even created, was to provide a place for paramedics to, you know, write, share, collaborate, read, learn from each other. And it sounds like Don't Forget Your Bubbles almost started with a very similar kind of ethos behind it.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, whilst a lot of our content is clinically based, some of the more, the posts that resonated with most people have not been about clinical stuff. It's about feelings and how we deal with stuff. And so, yeah, that's that stuff about imposter syndrome or writing about grief or how we deal with challenging cases or how we switch off. And again, yeah, you're right. It's that, that is a, first of all, you know, as a writer myself, it's a cathartic act to be able to put stuff out there. And it does help you process things. And it also helps you recognize that you are not alone, because everyone has, there is always someone that has been in the same situation as you. No matter how awful it is, there are people who recognize your suffering. And just by, you know, knowing that, it actually does make you feel a little bit less isolated.
I do wonder if, you know, a lot of the stress or anxiety about the way in which people feel about, you know, after being exposed to something and being a part of something, it relates to thinking that their response is abnormal.
And yeah, absolutely.
Really, it's just it's a normal reaction to an abnormal situation.
And so if you look at, so I think there's a really great example in a book called Lost Connections by Johan Hari. And basically he's talking about grief, and, you know, grief can be seen by some people as this depression, a profound depression. And, you know, you've lost someone that's really close to you and you don't want to do anything. And to the layperson, to the outside world, it could look like you're so profoundly depressed. But if you look in, you know, the diagnostic and statistical manual, so that basically the handbook of psychiatric conditions, grief is the exception to the diagnosis of major depression. So what it's really saying is that this, those feelings that you feel when you experience grief, whether that's because of death or a diagnosis or a loss of some sort, is, as you say, Nick, a completely normal response. It is normal to not want to talk to anyone, to want to just, you know, lock yourself away. And that normal can go on for months and months. But we don't talk about that, you're right. And that's potentially one of those things that can lead to PTSD, which is unfortunately common in paramedicine and in medicine as well. And so, you know, there's that opportunity to normalize things. And I think that's where something like the shift extension is great. It's that sharing the experience, letting people know that, hey, I went to this situation. This is how I felt. This is a normal thing. It also helps recognize them when it's not normal.
Hey, Andrew, I feel like I could, I mean, we could discuss some of this stuff all day. I mean, you've got such a wealth of knowledge and such interesting points of view. One of the things that I read recently that you had posted was about identity. It really resonated with me. You were talking about being a doctor. That's your identity. That's who you've been for, you know, several decades. But you're also a father. You're also a husband. You're also a teacher. You're also a friend to people, I think you had in the post. And you said sometimes it can be hard to remember that. You spent a large part of your life, I guess, identifying with being a doctor. What would happen if you can no longer be a doctor? Now, this really, really resonated with me a lot because I think a lot of people suffer from identity syndrome, you know, where they what they do for a profession is entwined so intrinsically with who they are that if they can no longer do that, they lose their identity, they lose a sense of themselves, particularly with people who have been doing it for, you know, more than 10, 20 years. What or how can people not create awareness of this? How can people manage this to mitigate any of the negative fallout from if they can't do something anymore? What was the purpose of even your post? I mean, is this something that you're looking at in the future? Is there
No, I'm certainly not thinking about giving up medicine, okay. But what I recognized is that over the last 15 years or so, my life balance, for want of a better term, has been skewed towards my identity as being a doctor. And so that I love what I do at work, and I would do as much of it as possible if I could. But there's other things going on. You know, I have friends, I have a partner, I have kids. And I think the first thing to do that I would really encourage everyone to try and do as an exercise, as a thought exercise, to sit down with a bit of paper and write down what their key roles are or what their identities are, you know, without judgment. So, you know, it could be podcaster, author, paramedic, partner, father, carer. What are all those identities they have? And sometimes it's a case of working out what those commonalities are of what's actually important. So for me, part of the identity, the various identities are all the same. It's all about caring and compassion and kindness. And that overarching identity holds everything in it more than, so let's say I can't be a doctor for whatever reason, you know, I don't want to think of anything, but it doesn't mean I can't still be kind and caring and compassionate. I can't be a writer for whatever reason, but it doesn't mean I can't still be curious and interested in teaching. And so those things help. So perhaps, for instance, let's say you've been a paramedic there for, you know, 10 years and you can't do that for whatever reason. There are still aspects of that job that are part of your core identity. So maybe the reason you wanted to become paramedic is because you like helping people, but also perhaps because you're curious about people and you want to learn more and you want to help. So then your avenue could be something completely different. It could be teaching. It could just be sitting there and listening and talking to people, because that's actually the aspect of the job you like. It's, you know, the bit about the job you're not like is not sticking cannulas in and intubating kids or adults or whoever it is. It's actually sitting down with someone when they are in a shitty moment and listening to them and making them feel better. And that is not being about being a paramedic. That's being a good human being. And I think that's, for me, that's stopping and looking at that that really, you know, big picture stuff is what I found really important. And I was finding I was getting burnt out and I was using work as my way of dealing with stress at home or stress doing other stuff. And so I was really leeching into that. Okay, I'm just going to do more and more and more work and abandoning other things. And what I've found over the last year or so is I've actually dropped the number of shifts I work in hospital, given myself more free time in inverted commas, because it's not, no time is free. And I've reset things a little bit. So now, whereas before I'd come home from work, I'd be exhausted. I'd have 1,001 things I had to do, emails to write, talks to write, blog posts to do. And I wouldn't have time. I'd kind of resent my kids a little bit because they were trying to push on my time for me. But now I've actually dropped some of those work hours. It's meant that I can structure my days a little better so I can do things like talking on podcasts with friends, that sort of thing, or writing blog posts or writing papers. And I also can spend time with my kids and move the laptop away and be present with them. It means my relationship with my partner, my children is better. I am less resentful of them. I am more productive. And, you know, work is just work at the end of the day.
All of us get replaced quickly if we can't do it anymore.
We're cogs in a machine. And it's really hard to think about that because we like to think we are the heroes of our own story. You know, every single case that people talk about, you know, whether it's writing on for you or for me, it's, I went in to see this patient and this is what I did. It's not about, oh yeah, I heard about this thing that someone else did. So we're always the heroes of our own story. And, you know, you want to be the hero of your shift. You want that thing to happen to you. But sometimes being the hero is about actually stopping doing stuff and spending time on other people.
So, Andy, you know, you're starting to see a lot more, especially around healthcare workers, whether doctors, nurses, paramedics, about being burnt out. And I think sometimes people are hesitant to step away from their role or their job because they put so much of their identity on that. So for paramedics, they don't want to leave ambulance services because they don't know where they'll get that level of identity from, because they go to work, they put on a uniform, it's well recognized. People show them respect. They feel like they're doing something good in the community and, you know, they've got a good, secure income, right? But there's obviously other things going on within that that causes them stress and frustration and can lead to burnout for all kinds of different facets. What advice would you give to people out there who are in those situations, who are struggling to, who want to be able to move on and try new things, but they're struggling with that, that identity and feel almost a bit trapped?
I think this is when friends are so important. Speak to people who have been in your situation and have made it through, and as so many people have, and recognize that, you know, there is so much you have no control over, you know, in both in your job and in your life. There are only a few things you have control over, and to work on those. You know, one of the things that we say that happens at work is that we'll have, you know, 10 ambulances coming in the hour. You guys are all ramped outside the door and bed managers are on our backs for shifting people through. And really, and the doctors and nurses are getting stressed and frustrated. And I say to them, you have no control over what's happening out in the world out there. I have no control over who is getting sick in the community or what ambulances are coming through. All I can control is what I can do right now. And that's the important thing. And so if people are feeling frustrated, annoyed, fed up with the system, that side of things, then it's a case of, okay, there's things in the system I can deal with and I can fix, and the things I can't fix, okay. If things are completely inappropriate and it's bullying and harassment, go to HR. But also, if you need a break, take a break. Don't be all macho, hard man. I don't need to take a break. I don't need to take time off. And I think it's one of the things that COVID has shown us now, that, you know, paramedics, doctors, nurses are really subject to this idea of presenteeism, that, you know, we don't get sick. We go to work, whatever. And now that we have such strict guidelines about, you know, not even being able to go to work if you've got a runny nose and a cough, you know, it actually makes it easier in some ways to step back and say, hey, I need to look after myself. Whereas before, I have been sent home from work with a temperature of, you know, 40 degrees and a tachy at 130. And I've got it, you know, I've swabbed myself at work and I've found out I've got influenza A. But I would still be at work and because I'm indispensable and the system will fall apart without me. That's clearly not true. And I have got better at saying, actually, things will carry on. The hospital will still be there tomorrow if I don't go in. There will still be patients to see. The truck will still be on the road if I don't go in. And that's not just about my own physical health, but also if I need to be off to support my partner or to look after my kids, that is the right thing to do. Making those decisions to look after myself, my own well-being, is important. You know, we have this problem that, you know, this gendered issue of who looks after kids at home. Why, if my children are sick, why should it be that my partner has to look after my kids? Why shouldn't I be taking the time off? It doesn't matter. Just because I earn more money, it doesn't mean that she shouldn't, you know, not have to be at home looking after them. And I think we just need to get a little bit better of standing up for ourselves in some ways and saying, actually, you know, I'm a human being. I deserve to be looked after. And I deserve to not be burnt out and be treated like a decent human being. And if that means I'm taking a month off for my own mental health or whatever it is, then do it. But as long as then when you take that time away from your job, whether, you know, let's say you're taking a week or 2 weeks off, that you don't just fill it with distractions and mind-numbing, you know, binge watching The Sandman and Stranger Things on Netflix and getting drunk all the time and going out partying, whatever it is. But you think, you actually spend a little bit of time thinking, okay, taking a deep breath and thinking, God, this feels great. Why does this feel great? You know, this feels great because I'm not getting phone calls every 5 seconds. I've got a decent sleep pattern. I'm eating properly. I'm looking after myself. I'm spending time with community. I'm feeling connected with people. And then maybe let's say you want to go back into your workplace. What are those things? What are those things that have happened in those 2 weeks off that have helped reset me? What do I need to keep on going when I'm back at work?
That's awesome.
I think recognition there too. I mean, one of the most important things I said there was the machine will go on. The machine will continue. And I think if people can recognize, you know, we've all got a vital part to play and we've all got important roles, but we're not that important as an individual. The system is important. It will continue in your absence. And so if you can recognize that, accept that, it should then assist you step back for things like you said, your own mental health leave, to I guess re-engage and find yourself again, sleep better, eat better, exercise better. There's a lot of pearls in what you just said. Hey, we're gonna have to wrap it up in a second, Andy. But I am curious. Now the naming things, the shift extension was named because Nick and I have suffered through, you know, a decade each of never knowing when we're going to get home. Our partners, our families, you know, family barbecues, dinners, they've all been affected by shift extensions. We laugh and we get given a finish time. So there was nothing that was kind of more pertinent for us than the name, the shift extension, because that's often, if Nick and I were working together and we're on a shift extension, I'm waiting for him to finish his godforsaken paperwork at the hospital. I'm looking for something to read. I'm looking for something to write. I'm looking for something to entertain me. And when we look at the analytics of the shift extension, people are on it at 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 o'clock in the morning. So it's been quite fitting for what it was, I guess, encouraged from. Where did Don't Forget the Bubbles, or Don't Forget Your Bubbles, which is it? Don't forget the bubbles.
I'm going to give you three options, Nick and Steve, and you can choose your own.
Okay.
One, because all children love playing with bubbles, and it's a really good assessment tool, a general assessment tool. So if you blow bubbles towards a neonate or a small kid, they will move, they will smile, they will fix and follow with their gaze, and they'll reach out to touch it.
That's number one.
That's number one.
Okay.
There's number two, which is a quote by the famous Canadian physician, William Osler, which was, there is no bubble more iridescent blown than that blown by the wisest teacher.
Okay. Okay.
Number three, when you're trying to intubate a sick kid, you're putting the laryngoscope in and you can see absolutely nothing but pitch black. You push down on their chest and you look for the saliva bubbles, and that's where your vocal cords are.
Nick?
Well, I'm a big believer in utilizing YouTube to determine if my patient's sick or not. So I put some Paw Patrol on, and if they distract away and they're happy, then kid's fine. If they're still screaming, like, kid's sick. Right? So I'm going to go with A. I think.
So you're going with number one. Don't forget the bubble.
I do like number two, though. That's very philosophical.
And I mean, you're talking about Paw Patrol, Nick, because you're ripping out like a phone or an iPad. That's like your digital bubbles, right?
That's okay. Great.
Well, I think I'm leaning towards one as well. I think number one makes sense to me. I'm going to
quickly.
If I'm advocating for the patient, I want to reassure them and I want to distract them and I want to, you know, show them that I care. So I'm gonna bring a packet of bubbles with me.
Yep. And I'll give you both. You score both on there. Well done, guys.
has the use of bubbles decreased since COVID? Like, did you have some?
It's a good point. So, interesting. I actually wrote a blog post on it because there's some evidence that blowing bubbles can transmit COVID, and you can, which is ridiculous. So they were blowing. But so instead, you go to like to Big W and pick up one of the mechanical machines that pours them out, and it does the job.
Do you have like? Can you blow bubbles with hand sanitizer? Or is that?
I haven't tried it.
Like, should we call it? Don't forget the sanitizer bubbles.
Wow, Nick, I think you're onto the next best thing: sanitizing bubbles.
Maybe that's like a side business. Don't forget bubbles.
You can have like a product. I'll give you 10%.
Yeah, done.
One of the listeners has just stolen it, so you're both too late. It's been patented.
We'll have to publish this episode in 12 months. So. Hey, Andy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, mate. We really appreciate it. It's been an absolutely fantastic conversation. Congratulations again and to you and the team on Don't Forget the Bubbles. And for any of our listeners who are looking for a fantastic pediatric resource, they can find it just through Google.
Yeah, and don't forget the bubbles.com. Easy.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you, Andy. And thank you, Steve. Thanks, it's Andy. Always a pleasure, mate.
Thanks, Nick. Take care.